for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. 1959 saw the emergence of Malcolm X and Fidel Castro, the foundations of the 1960s free love, the beginnings of indie film, free jazz, and the first museum devoted to non-objective art. In a new book, Slate.com columnist Fred Kaplan explains how everything changed half a century ago. His new book is titled 1959. Fred Kaplan joins me in the studio. He won the Pulitzer Prize back in 1983 on his reporting on the nuclear arms race for the Boston Globe. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good to have you here, Fred.
Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure.
You know, it's interesting. I looked at your title and I said, well, since that was the year I was married, I think I'll just have to do this book.
Well, I'll have to get that into the paperback edition.
But now, why did you choose 1959?
Well, it started as a personal thing. Several years ago, it suddenly occurred to me that a lot of my favorite groundbreaking movies, books, record albums all came out in 1959. So I began to wonder, well, is this just a coincidence? Did something significant happen? Was there broader trends going on? And at first, rather casually, and then more intensely, I looked into it and began to realize not only did a lot of things happen that year, but I came to the conclusion that it truly was a pivotal year in American history. I mean, that the country was going in one direction, and then it started going in another direction.
1959 versus, say, 1960, mm-hmm. the baby boom years, yeah. all the rest of it. Why 59?
Well,
what happened?
I think a lot of things that we associate with the 60s and the baby boomers actually took hold in the late 50s by the generation that grew up amid war and depression and emerged afterwards disheartened, disgruntled, revolted by the fact of the phony peace that followed. So, for example, you know, you talked about, the anti-war movement or free love movement and so forth. Well, you know, the Vietnam War actually began in 1959. The first two American casualties were that year. The birth control pill, FDA approval for the birth control pill, started in 1959, which, of course, unleashed not just the sexual revolution, but the feminist revolution.
Margaret Sanger's dream.
Margaret Sanger, right, exactly. It's a great story. This woman, Margaret Sanger, this firebrand socialist suffragist radical.
Born in 1898.
Yeah, who was getting arrested in the 20s and 30s, you know, when it was illegal to even talk about contraception, meets a renegade biologist named Gregory Pincus at a dinner party in the early 50s, says, it's always been my dream for someone to invent a magic pill that can prevent women from getting pregnant. And he goes, well, we might be able to do that. And she was head of the Planned Parenthood Foundation. She funneled money to him. By the end of the decade, there it was. I mean, it's an extraordinary story, really.
And she really, really had that as a lifelong dream.
That was her lifelong dream?
Because her mother had died so
young. Her mother
young.
Died in childbirth. She was a nurse in the Lower East Side of Manhattan when it was slums. She saw women self-administering abortions and dying from them. I mean, it was an extraordinary time. It was, you know, people don't realize, it wasn't until the early 70s that all the laws against contraception were taken off the books formally.
And here we are, 50 years later, mm-hmm. the issue of abortion is once again.
It's still there?
It's still there. It never went away. Fred Kaplan is with me. His new book titled 1959, The Year Everything Changed. You may have your own thoughts. You may have your own contradictions, but give us a call, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow at WAMU.org, and you can also reach us through Facebook and Twitter. We were awfully worried about nuclear war in 1959.
Well, that was the year, you know, when everybody thought there was a missile gap. The Russians were way ahead of us in missilery. That was, 1959 was defined by the intelligence agencies as the year of maximum danger. It was the year when scientists began to detect dangerous levels of strontium-90 in milk. When Nelson Rockefeller and others were urging everybody to dig fallout shelters in their backyard, when Catholic magazines like America were having debates in their pages on whether it was ethically permissible to shoot your neighbor if they tried to break into your fallout shelter. It was a crazy time. I mean, what was going on in 59? And a lot of this was technologically driven and also driven by the new quest into outer space that was going on there. It was this time when there were prospects for both infinite expansion and instant annihilation. And I think the duality of that unleashed a sense of urgency and tremendous creative energies. And I think we're seeing some of that today as well.
Well, I was about to say, Fred, with all the concerns on people's minds today, as far as the economy, as far as our relations with other countries, two wars going on, why look back? Why concentrate on a year, even as you say, it may have been absolutely dramatic in the shift that occurred? Why look back?
Because I think we can learn some lessons of what we did and did not do the last time that there was a momentous change.
Such as?
Well, I mean, well, first let's do a little list of some of the things that happened.
All right.
We broke out into space. The very first thing in my book, January 2nd, 1959, the Russians launched the Lunik 1 space vehicle. It's the first rocket to break free of the Earth's gravitational pull and start to orbit around the sun like a planet. Next issue of Time magazine, there's a publisher's note hailing the achievement, and this is the way Time magazine wrote back then, as a turning point in the multi-billion-year history of the solar system, in that a creature of the sun's planet had at last evolved to where it could break free of its gravitational pull. And what was going on was people breaking free of gravitational pulls, literal and metaphorical, all over. This was the first year of transatlantic nonstop jet travel for passengers. It was the year, so there was this sense that the world was getting smaller, that America was reaching out to the world was reaching out to America. It was the year of the microchip. I mean, you know, there's nothing in this room that could function without the microchip. It was the year when free jazz, of pop art, of just everything, again, it was the beginning of a heightened sense of racial discrimination. And new techniques to combat that discrimination. And so what you see, what's going on now, really, I think we have the same kind of sense of this almost ecstatic sense of technological progress. Now it's even maybe not quite as dramatic because we are expecting change. In 1959, there was this kind of enchantment with the new, this idea that tomorrow is going to be something different from yesterday. Maybe better, maybe worse, but an adventure. Now, I think what's different now is that we expect tomorrow to be completely different.
Except that the changes that you're describing in 1959 were, if I can lump them all together, somehow we could define them as beginning to break free. If you talk about birth control, if you talk about a flight out into space, if you're talking about free love, free jazz, a new museum, you're talking about breaking free from boundaries. It seems to me that right now, 50 years later, you're absolutely right that technologically we are looking forward, but somehow, some way, because of economics, we've somehow come to a point where we realize we can't break free.
Well, economics is it, but you know, at the end of the 50s, or right up until the end of the 50s, there was this explosion of post-war prosperity, which allowed a lot of these things. But in 1958 and 59, there was a serious recession. I mean, in retrospect, maybe not as serious as the one we're going through now, but it was thought to be very serious at the time. And everybody thought the Soviets were leaping ahead of us in every realm. There was a severe depression psychologically that maybe the United States was not up to it anymore. And I think this also unleashed some of these tensions. I mean, it was in 1958 midterm elections when you had the sclerotic president Eisenhower, who was, we now know that actually he was shrewder than he seemed to be at the time. But at the time, he was the oldest president to be in office up until then. He'd had a heart attack, a stroke. He was, when Khrushchev came to the country, Khrushchev was only 4 years younger than he was, but he seemed 10 or 15 years younger. You know, the Republicans lost something like 16 seats in the Senate in the midterm election and 40 in the House. I mean, there are certain parallels going on here. And then this
parallels.
Young President John Kennedy, young President Barack Obama. I mean, let's look at what you said at the beginning of this program. You can view us on, you know, Facebook, Twitter. You can do this. You can do that. I mean, in 1959, in the mid-50s, about half of the households in America had TVs.
Exactly.
By the end of the decade, three quarters.
Fred Kaplan, his new book is titled 1959, The Year Everything Changed. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. And you can reach us through Facebook and Twitter. And our first emailer for Fred Kaplan, who's just written a new book titled 1959, The Year Everything Changed. Richard wants you, Fred, to comment on the albums you liked that year.
Right. Well, the albums were, for example, there was Miles Davis' Kind of Blue, Ornette Coleman's The Shape of Jazz to Come, the first comedy album by Lenny Bruce, The Sick Humor of Lenny Bruce, Charles Mingus's Dave Brubeck's Time Out. These were albums that broke barriers of what was understood to be jazz or comedy at the time. In terms of jazz, it broke through the idea that chord changes were the fundamental instrument for improvisation. For comedy, it broke through the barriers that, you know, what was comedy was making jokes about your mother-in-law or your psychiatrist instead of politics, sex, religion, social hypocrisy.
And it was the manner in which Lenny Bruce delivered that comedy, the words he used.
It was very much like a jazz man. Ralph J. Gleason, who was a jazz critic, compared his improvisational comedy bits to the solos of John Coltrane and Charlie Parker.
What about rap? It seems to me that some of that evolved from what Lenny Bruce began with.
I think that's right. And also jazz, the rhythm of it, absolutely. Motown was also invented or, you know, started in 1959. And that grew out of jazz, the Funk Brothers, who were the the musical band behind all those great singers of the Motown years. They were Detroit jazz musicians, and what they were injecting into pop music as jazz became a little bit more academic was the rhythms and the feelings of jazz, which was up until then missing in kind of the doo-wop sort of years of American rock.
Here's an email from David, who says, Diane, while you're waxing nostalgic about Margaret Sanger, please at least mention that she was a very strong proponent of eugenics and that she sought not to merely limit births generally, but to limit the births of certain very specific groups, undesirables as she saw them. This author's credibility slipped sharply with me because of his embarrassingly iconic version of her work. You talk a great deal in the book about her eugenics.
Well, there definitely is. There's a dark side to Margaret Sanger, but I think she gets a bad rap because of how she's viewed it by the light of contemporary standards. Margaret Sanger grew up, again, she was a nurse in the tenements of the Lower East Side of New York, where women were having 10, 12 children.
Even her own mother had pregnancy.
And died in childbirth.
Right.
She viewed eugenics, and again, by contemporary standards, it doesn't look too good, but she saw these women, largely poor women, who could not get a doctor to prescribe them contraceptives, which you needed to do back then, as having more children than they wanted to have. And so she saw it limiting that way. But I can go further. I mean, the initial tests, the human tests for the birth control pill, they went down to housing projects in Puerto Rico to do these tests, to test for side effects. They got relatives to sign forms to give the pills to women in insane asylums. I mean, medical ethics were not once. But this was nothing. Nobody thought anything was strange about this. Medical ethics were not what they are today.
Here's another email from Robert. He says, "Does the author touch on the topics? The development of the expansion of the interstate highway system and the expansion of the American suburbs." Mm-hmm. The suburbs traumatized many large American cities.
Well, that's true. There was this escape from the cities at the same time that cities were becoming centers of explosive energies of art and commerce and culture. The interstate highway system, it's very funny. One of the inventions of the time that didn't go anywhere, there's always exciting technological advances that turn out in retrospect to be follies. Westinghouse came up with an idea to create a system of radar transmitters on the median strips of the highways and then radar receivers on your bumpers so that you could drive from coast to coast without having your hand on the steering wheel. So they, in fact, at the 1959 Radio Engineer Show, where the microchip was also introduced, the New York Times story the next day focused on three inventions. One of them was the microchip, but it was the third one, and it had two paragraphs. Half of the story was about this marvelous new device by Westinghouse to allow you to drive coast to coast. So you never, when you're in the middle of a revolution, sometimes you don't know what's going to be the truly revolutionary.
And speaking of ideas that went nowhere and that bridge to nowhere, In 1959, Alaska became a state.
That's right. There was this, you know, there was this tremendous palpable sense of that the country was being closed in, this idea of the new frontier that Kennedy talked about. I looked into where did this phrase come from, and what I discovered was it was just in the air. Everybody was talking about the new frontier for this, the new frontier for that. So Alaska was certainly an outreach of that. But what Kennedy talked about the new frontier, he meant it as the 60s. The new frontier was the 60s. It was the future. It was tomorrow. And Kennedy sort of was the coalescence, the embodiment of all these trends and sensations that were moving the nation at the time. He was young. Many people thought too young. He was an outsider. which maybe even 4 years earlier, both of those things would have worked against him. But in 1960, or even 59 when he started to run, on the edge of what was perceived to be a new epoch, they worked in his favor. And I think the same could be said of Barack Obama in our own time.
I have to tell you, as someone who was in my early 20s at the time, our sense of optimism was just enormous.
Yeah.
It was endless. You know, you assumed that, and I wasn't working at all at the time. I was home with young children. But we assumed that my husband would progress, that his government job would continue, that his transition into private law would simply move us forward. We were able to buy a house on very little money. Everything was optimism until the assassination of John F. Kennedy.
And then
things changed.
But even at the time, and I was only 5 years old, so maybe I can't speak with authority. But again, there was this duality. Everything was going to be horrible if we didn't get blown up in the meantime, remember. There was this tremendous fear of nuclear war. And, you know, there was the Berlin crisis, the Cuban Missile Crisis, both of which led very
I
closely.
I remember that
day. And the archival documents show us that this was not a misperception.
We
really did get very close to
that. And, of course, Fidel Castro came here to the United States.
You know, the fascinating thing about Castro, a lot of people, including people who were your age or older at the time, remember the later visit, the 1960 visit, when Castro came and he stormed uptown to the Teresa Hotel in Harlem, and he and Khrushchev went arm in arm to the General Assembly. What they don't remember was that in the spring of 59, just a few months after he came to power, he came here, he was treated as a hero.
Exactly.
People thought this is something new under the sun, a revolutionary who is bound neither to capitalism nor communism. There's a picture in my book of Castro eating an ice cream cone at the Bronx Zoo. He spoke before 30,000 people at Central Park. The New York Times was hailing him as something out of the age of Sam Adams and Thomas Jefferson. Well, you know, he sort of disproved all of this at the time. But it was an example of how we were looking for something that was new, that broke out of current patterns.
And certainly, as you mentioned earlier, somehow the Vietnam War began with the killing of two people.
Of two military advisors in August of 1959. You know, we got into, this was an example of the United States flexing its muscle out in the world without really knowing what it was bumping into. We now know that this, North Vietnamese viewed this as a continuation of the colonial war with the United States replacing France. We thought it was a Cold War thing against Chinese surrogates. And, we got wrapped in that. Basically, what happened in 1959 was that the North Vietnamese Communist Party decided that we were going to unify the country by military force. The United States was the new enemy, and we fell into that trap.
And so it began.
So it began. Everything. And at that time, C. Wright Mills, who is a prominent sort of maverick sociologist, wrote an essay called Letter to the New Left. There was no new left at the time. He was hoping to build one. An undergraduate named Tom Hayden at the University of Michigan read that essay, was inspired by it, wrote the Port Huron Statement, which became the foundation for the Students for a Democratic Society. So again, it's another example of something that we think of as the 60s, but actually grew out of trends and developments and inspirations of the late 50s.
If you've just joined us, Fred Kaplan is with me. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer. His new book is all about the year he says everything changed. It's titled 1959. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Let's go first to Ada, Michigan. Good morning, Carol. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
Hello.
Hi. Well, I just find it fascinating. I was 6 years old in 1959, and so I've kind of lived through all of this, although I don't remember what happened in 1969, really. But I just think the title of, you know, when everything changed, Diane, you mentioned something a little bit ago in the program there about how where we are now about it. And it seems like we're kind of wrestling as a country with, well, what are the basics that really don't change, you know, because while so much changed and so much has been up for grabs for so long, I think even our economy right now is a result of thinking that we could defy laws and gravity and, you know, just basic humanity, the needs of basic humanity and kind of a basic structure of right and wrong and get away with it, you know?
Yeah, that's very interesting.
That's a very good point. Yeah. And in fact, you know, I should point out that the things that I write about in this book, especially if you get to the last chapter, you'll see that it's not an unqualified celebration of all of this. I think this idea that we can go to the moon and we can escape all boundaries and we can destroy all structures, while it had initially a very positive effect in freeing some of the shackles of society, taken too far, it wrecked our society as well. You know, the sexual revolution was a good thing, but it also destroyed a lot of marriages. The end of censorship was a great thing, but it led to the release of really rank pornography. The idea that you could get rid of structures in art led to a lot of sloppy art. So it can go in both directions.
Carol, thanks for calling at 27 before the hour. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And now to Oxford, Ohio. Good morning, Eric. You're on the air.
Hey, I just wanted to talk about, you mentioned earlier the sort of feeling of freedom that the technology was giving. Now, I'm very far removed from 1959. I'm only 23. But you mentioned how these days, you know, this time around, it doesn't feel as much like technology is this new and exciting thing. It's more that we're sort of expecting change. And in some ways, I wanted to disagree. I feel that especially the way the internet is starting to be used, such as what was going on with getting information out of Iran in the early stages when nothing else could, it's really exciting to see how we're just sort of scratching the surface of this historically relatively new technology.
No, that's a very good point. I agree with you. I guess the point I was making, not that we're not excited by it, but there is now an expectation of this kind of, what is the principle that, you know, the chips get double in speed or capacity every 18 months? It's been called a law. But no, you're right. And it's interesting, you know, the kinds of things that happened in the late 50s, the breakdown not only of authority, but between audience and art, between spectacle and spectator, that's really accelerating to a tremendous point now. Where, you know, it's things like YouTube and Twitter, that these edges are not only blurring, they're becoming obliterated. And yeah, there's something very exciting about that, but also people worry that it might destroy a sense of a national culture. If everybody is off in their own little bubble,
yeah,
you know, what happens to the wider culture?
That's the question. Eric, how do you see it?
I don't know. It is an interesting point. I hadn't thought of it in the sense of causing the eradication of culture in that sense, of a sort of national culture in that sense. Because it does in some ways blur the boundaries, not just, as you said, between viewer and audience, but it also sort of, in some ways, starts obliterating national boundaries when you can easily connect and talk to anyone anywhere in the world. In fact, I think there's a website whose name I cannot recall whose sole purpose is just to enter you into a chat conversation with some random other person anywhere in the world.
I hadn't heard of that one. But no, that's sort of what happened in this period that I'm writing about, this sense of instantaneity, of spontaneity, something that happens right when you want it to happen.
And somehow it can happen.
And it can, voila, to everybody's amazement, yeah.
The other thing that struck me about 1959 in your book is that both Toyota and Datsun came into
being. Right. There was the International Auto Show in New York, the third, but it was twice as big as the one in 1958. This was also the year, not coincidentally, that the Edsel was killed. Ford's the first time one of the big three introduced a car with enormous fanfare, and it sputtered. It
Why?
Died.
How?
Because it was too big. It was too. They put too many frills on it. The United States was just going through this recession. Nobody could afford it. People started looking into smaller cars, and Datsun and Toyota at the International Auto Show was sort of the harbinger of that new trend.
What happened to Datsun?
Well, Datsun, you know, didn't it get merged into something else many years later?
I think so, yeah. But here we are.
But still, it was around for quite a long time.
And here we are with Toyota, very much in the forefront of cars that Americans do like. We'll take a short break here, and when we come back, we have callers waiting in Fairfax, in Detroit, and in Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy, by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, presenting an in-depth look at the digital generation at edutopia.org, and by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary on the web at healthreform.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
After the Iranian government revoked all foreign press passes, Roger Cohen of the New York Times stayed in Tehran to cover the protests. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with him about witnessing the protests and the attacks against the demonstrators. We'll also talk about how the protests affect President Obama's ability to open relations with Iran. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And we're back with Fred Kaplan, whose book is titled 1959, The Year Everything Changed. Pete in Charlotte, North Carolina writes, I've not been in the room for the entire hour, but I did hear what was mentioned about music. I didn't hear anything about what is now called the day the music died. It might be my bias since I love their music, but I feel that Buddy Holly at 22 and Ritchie Valens at 17 did more for music than most artists can do in a full lifetime. Yes, they died early in the year, but their legacy is still felt today.
Well, yeah, by February 3rd, I believe, 1959 was the year the plane crashed. I think what happened in pop music after they died was that it did go in a completely different direction. I think the Motown, Berry Gordy bought that house on January 12th. The first hit was Money, That's What I Want in August. The Beatles, or what they were called at the time, the Silver Beatles over across the ocean, had been doing things in the Buddy Holly tradition. They started switching over to Motown, and that's what created the the sex, drugs, and rock and roll brand of rock and roll that I grew up with in the 60s.
I love it that you actually remember dates. And here is something from the iPod of Allison, who's listening in Ann Arbor, Michigan. She says, I've always personally felt that 20 years earlier, 1939, was equally, if not more, important. The Depression started to wind down. World War II started. Hollywood's era ended and started a whole new era, one with women's advances and breakthroughs and the end of the U.S.'s isolationist policy, aside from World War I, plus the end of an era, one that would never come again.
Well, you know, somebody said that you can point to any year and find something.
Of course.
I think what I was aiming at was where was the pivot that explains a lot about the world that we're living in today? And I think a lot of those things were in 1959. You mentioned the end of Hollywood. I don't know if that's true. I mean, 1959, there was John Cassavetes' Shadows, which was the first film to be made outside the Hollywood system. And that unleashed the whole era of indie films, which I think have a lot more to do with the kinds of films that were made in the subsequent decades than, although 39 was a great year for films, of course, Gone with the Wind, The Wizard of Oz, but you don't see movies like that being made today. That it was almost the end of that era, not the beginning of a new one.
And someone has sent in a correction. Dotson is still with us.
Stop, sorry.
It took on its parents' company name, Nissan.
Ah, there we go.
There you go. Let's go to Detroit, Michigan. Good morning, Jerry. You're on the air.
Good morning to both of you.
Hello. Hi there.
Okay, in response to a caller earlier who was talking about Margaret Sanger, I just wanted to know from you what your take is on the effort by some, you know, by some, if not all, conservative whites to try to use the African-American eugenics issue in an effort to both smear and discredit Margaret Sanger.
Well, I mean, it cannot be denied that she was in favor of eugenics, but I don't think it didn't have a racial component. It did have a class component. I think that, you know, in the 70s, when some of the side effects of the pill came to light and there was a kind of a feminist revulsion against the pill, I think that the reputation of Margaret Sanger became tied up in that whole counterculture, and she fell victim to it in some revisionist histories.
Thanks for calling, Jerry. Now to Fairfax, Virginia. Hi there, Randy. You're on the air.
Hi, and thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Like myself and many in my generation, we kind of grew up looking back towards the 60s as being a nexus of change in the United States. And your guest is saying that, you know, 1959 was kind of what led into it. One thing that I felt a lot of people overlook was actually World War II was the impetus for many of the changes that were to come and really bust out in the 60s. You had the German rocketry experiments, which, of course, we took from Germany once we took over the country. There were German interrogation experiments that used drugs, in particular mescaline, that we, under the CIA aegis, used in its place, LSD. And there are books written about LSD experiments by CIA and other government organizations, which led to this whole pop art counterculture movement. You had women in the workforce in great numbers that later on, I think, gave them a taste of freedom that they had not experienced prior to that. Blacks in the armed forces, which led directly to civil rights. He spoke of the free jazz form, well, bebop, obviously, is the precursor to that, and that also came about during World War II. And when it was all said and done, the United States was basically the only country left standing with a major industrial infrastructure, which, of course, led to the prosperity of the 50s and 60s until these other countries that had been devastated by the war were finally able to, you know, get back into the game, so to speak, and provide us more competition, which we see now in great amount.
Certainly, but lots to what Randy said.
Well, you know, nothing emerges out of nothing. The people who most surprising a number of my heroes or anti-heroes were born between 1925 and 1930. They were definitely shaped by the war. Absolutely, they were either they grew up in it or they were the young privates and sergeants in it. And but then after the war was over, the people in charge of the country and the culture were just aiming to restore what was there before. And it took about 15 years for them to come of a certain age that they could put their own imprint on the culture. And that's when things began to move. You mentioned bebop. Obviously, the people in free jazz learned everything from Charlie Parker. But what was happening with what Miles Davis and Ornette Coleman and others were doing in the late 50s was finding a way out of the harmonic trap that they saw bebop leading into, some new way, something beyond the 4-4 chord change driven jazz. And but you're right, everything that happens, no matter how revolutionary, is either a continuation or a revolt against what happened before, in some ways both. And I think what the significance of 59 was that a bunch of things from all realms of life converged, and it was instigated by this generation that came up through the war, as you mentioned. Absolutely.
Randy, thanks for your call. Let's take a caller here in Washington, D.C. Good morning, David. You're on the air. Go right ahead.
Good morning, Diane. My 1959 was actually a sad year in my family. At the age of 6 years old, my young mother committed suicide.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
And, well, I mean, we've had a lot of years to get over it.
Yeah.
But it's interesting to me because this sounds like I'm going to buy this book and read it. Because my father and mother, who both grew up poor, arrived at adulthood, and my father got an education, took advantage of all the things that the 1950s had to offer, moved to the suburbs, bought the house, bought the new car, had three children all in the 1950s. I was the oldest. I mean, he had it all going, and yet the conventional wisdom in our family is that my mom just buckled under all of the pressure. And I was just wondering if there was sort of a societal downside to all this surge of hope in the 1950s?
Well, I can tell you one. It was that most women were expected to be in the home to take care of those children. And there was a lot of pressure. There was a lot of loneliness. There was a lot of isolation. Judy in Lovettsville, Virginia writes, not so in the workplace was 1959, a year of heady change. As a beginning journalist, I knew that firsthand because more than one potential employer told me that, except for the women's pages, they would not hire people of my sex.
Right.
So, I mean, you had those kinds of societal, I won't call them restrictions, but there were biases in place.
Oh, absolutely. And in terms of gender and race as well, the thing that happened in 1959 was creating the foundation for the changes to come. In the case of women, it was the birth control pill. The birth control pill allowed, no longer could an employer say, well, I can't hire this woman because one spontaneous night of sex with her husband might load her with a kid and she's going to have to leave the workplace. And so Gloria Steinem, her first freelance article in Esquire, 1962, she said that the pill is going to create what she called the autonomous girl, someone who could look at work, love, and even marriage the same way that a man did. And it's interesting in terms of your own family, you know, if you look at the culture, Rabbit Run, Revolutionary Road, the first episode of Mad Men takes place in 1959. There was definitely, as you know, part of it was breaking out of the city. I mean, suburbanization can be a real, at least especially in its early period, could be a real soul quencher, you know.
David,
you know,
that was...
I just read Revolutionary Road last month for the first time, and it was like reading my family's
Wow. Yeah.
Thank you, Frank. Good luck.
Well, yeah. I'm so sorry you lost your mother at such an early age. That had to have been really traumatic for you. I'm glad you called this morning.
Thank you.
All right, let's go now to Rochester, New York. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Diane.
Hi there.
Hey, congratulations on your 50th.
Yes, my 50th wedding anniversary is coming up in December. Thank you.
Well, I was just coming up in August.
Good.
And you mentioned earlier that Alaska became a state in 59.
Right.
Okay, now my bride and I never introduce her as my wife. I always still, after 50 years, introduce her as my bride.
Good for you.
We married in August, and we honeymooned in Hawaii. Now, Hawaii then was a terrible
outpost. That was an exotic thing to do back then.
Oh, yeah, there was nothing there except military.
Mm-hmm.
And the Royal Hawaiian had a small steamship line that brought in tourists of their own for, you know, on a little steamship. I think that in 1959, Hawaii was in the process of becoming a state.
Right, in 1960 it was actually approved, yeah.
Actually approved then. Well, congratulations on your 50th as well, and give our best to your bride. Thanks for calling. Let's go now to Stu. He's in South Bend, Indiana at 6 minutes before the hour. Let me just remind you, you are listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Go right ahead, Stu.
Good morning. I enjoy your program.
Thank you so much.
In 1959, I was a lieutenant in the Quartermaster Corps at Fort Lee, Virginia. Mm-hmm. And one of our courses was the responsibility of quartermaster to help in cleanup and detox, or whatever you call it, for personnel after a nuclear attack.
Oh, yeah.
I had a senior officer who called me into his class one day to help him. He was teaching a class on that subject to a number of foreign officers from the Middle East, from South America, you know. And when the class was just about over, he'd given a test, and he said, "I hope you will understand what you just took a test on, that you will use when you get to Vietnam." This is in early 1959, not if, but when.
Well, you know, it is interesting when the French were surrounded at Dien Bien Phu back in 1954, John Foster Dulles, who was Eisenhower's Secretary of State, wanted to offer them two tactical nuclear weapons. And Eisenhower said, "No, we're not going that route." And thank God the people who were president in Vietnam, whatever other horrors they committed, ruled against doing that. Although there were a number of military officers who, listen, if you were in the military coming up through the 50s, the nuclear weapon was... We didn't have very many conventional forces. That's what war was thought to be, and it was thought that that's how that's the kind of weapon that would dominate future warfare. So, you know, we can, you know, if Barry Goldwater had been elected president, we probably would have.
Thanks for calling, Stu. You know, 1954, the year Brown v. Board of Education, but still civil rights had such a long way to go. Yeah. And by the way, Congressman Abercrombie of Hawaii called to remind us that Hawaii did become a state on August 17, 1959.
You know, I think it's in my book, and I misstated it on the air. Sorry
about that. Misstated it. That's okay. We're very appreciative
to the
congressman.
Listening.
Of course, he's always listening. Now, civil rights.
Well, it's very, as you mentioned, 54, Brown versus Board of Education, but not that much happened right away. It, you know, everybody, 1957, Lyndon Johnson gets passed the Civil Rights Act of 1957. It's not thought to be a very big deal, but it created the Civil Rights Commission. And in 1959, they came out with their first report. I got my copy on eBay. You can, too. It's a fascinating document. It's about 600 pages. It catalogs racial discrimination in housing, education, and the voting booth. It led to hearings across the country. It got Martin Luther King to change his entire approach to what civil rights movement should be.
And finally, in 1964, Voting Rights
The Voting Act. Rights Act.
Fred Kaplan, thank you
oh, well, thank
for
you.
Being here.
It's been a real pleasure.
Well, and quite a reminder of our history 50 years ago and what's happened since there. Fred Kaplan calls 1959 the year everything changed. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.